A few weeks ago, we explored how Jews and Christians often have strongly divergent readings of the exact same passage of the Hebrew Scripture. I use the analogy from the Yale literary scholar Harold Bloom that the way he sees the way Christians read Jewish Scripture is that Christians stole our watch and for the last 2,000 years have been trying to tell us what time it is. From a related perspective this morning, I want to explore how Jews sometimes read Christian scriptures and the ways that can illuminate aspects and background of Christian scriptures that come out of the first century Jewish context. In particular, I want to look at the Jesus' parables. Next week, we'll consider passages from the ancient Chinese Book of Wisdom, the Tao Te Ching. So you can kind of have these previous two sermons in mind for how we look at the ways of reading that ancient Chinese Book of Wisdom. And when I think about the parables, one of the stories that always comes to mind is a few years ago, I helped write a curriculum for a week-long youth camp with a team of volunteers. And when we were doing that, and we came up with the theme that day of that week of running with the parables, we wanted to invite the young people to think about how do we not just hear these parables as about a long time ago? How do we run with them? How do we inculcate them and incorporate them into our lives and into our living? And one of the youth ministers, somewhat oddly, was like, "Oh, I want to design the T-shirt," and we're like, "All right, Dale, you can design the T-shirt." And so when he came back with the design, he said, okay, the T-shirts have to be red. And he had a path going and two young people running, and he had two bulls behind them. And he said, Do you get it? Does anybody get it? Why two bulls? The parables, right? Running with the parables. Yes, yes. All right. And part of what inspired me to preach about the parables from a Jewish perspective is a new book called Short Stories by Jesus, The Enigmatic Parables of a Controversial Rabbi by Amy Jo Levine. Now, have any of you read anything by Amy Jo Levine or seen her in person? She's really fantastic if you ever get a chance to see her in person. She's a Jewish New Testament scholar. So she was raised Jewish. She is Jewish. She attends an Orthodox Jewish synagogue. But she's has a PhD in New Testament studies. And she teaches at Vanderbilt University. She describes herself as a Yankee Jewish feminist who teaches at a predominantly Christian seminary in the buckle of the Bible Belt. And Levine's book invites us into an act of listening anew to Jesus' parables, of imagining what the parables would have sounded like to the people that originally heard them, who had no idea that Jesus would one day be proclaimed Son of God by millions, no idea even that he would later be crucified by Rome. What would they have heard just a Jewish storyteller telling them when they heard these parables? From a Unitarian Universalist perspective, I hear this view as inviting us to see the parables as about deeds, not creeds. Many traditional interpretations of the parables see these stories as about how great God is. It doesn't really have anything to do with us. It's just about how great God is. But a deeds, not creeds point of view invites us to consider the ways that Rabbi Jesus is inviting us not just to believe differently, but to act differently ourselves. In that spirit, I invite you to hear this parable recorded for us in the 20th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, to listen to it with an ear toward deeds, not creeds. Listen for how this story might be inviting us to change, just as it was inviting people in the first century to change. For the beloved community is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for the usual daily wage, he sent them into the vineyard. So that would have been around dawn, around 6 a.m. 3 hours later, around 9 o'clock, he saw others in the marketplace, wanting work but not able to find it. And so he said to them, "You too, go into my vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right." When he went out again about noon and about 3 o'clock, he did the same thing. He still saw people out there wanting to work but not able to, and he sent them into his vineyard. And when he asked them why they were still there, they said, "No one has hired us." When evening came, so he started at 6 a.m., so when we get all the way to 6 p.m., when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his manager, "Call the laborers and give them their pay, beginning with the last and then going to the first." And when those hired about 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage. Now, when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received the usual daily wage. And when they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you've made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me way back at dawn for the usual daily wage? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give this last the same as what I give to you. Or are you envious because I am generous?" As you've heard me say before, the universalist half of our UU heritage is about the shift from teaching that all will be universally saved in the next world and that hell doesn't exist in the afterlife, to teaching that we should focus instead not on the next world, but on loving the hell out of this world. Likewise, one traditional interpretation of this passage, often known as the parable of the workers in the vineyard, is that God is the landowner, the vineyard is our work in this world, and the end of the day and the payment we get then, which metaphorically you should hear is about the end of our lives, is whom the landowner God will reward with heaven. And read through an otherworldly lens, this parable can be seen as teaching. It's not about us. It's about how generous God is, and that God is more generous than we expect or deserve and chooses to let people into heaven who have what we used to call a deathbed baptism, right? Augustine famously prayed, "God, make me chaste, but not yet." So is this parable about God being generous even with those who do just a tiny bit of good during their life, equally to those who have done good their whole lives? In the words of the parable, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day, the burden of a lifetime of good deeds, and the scorching heat." But if we take up Amy Jill Levine's challenge to consider how this story would have been heard by impoverished Jewish peasants 2,000 years ago, what if we listen for what Rabbi Jesus may have been saying, not about God, not about the next world, but about us? About this world and this life. What if instead of calling this story the parable of the workers in the vineyard, we consider some of the alternative titles that have been proposed? The parable of the complaining day laborers. The parable of the surprising salaries. The parable of the humane capitalist. The conscientious boss. The last hired are the first paid. How to prevent peasants from unionizing. Debating a fair wage, lessons for both management and employment, and the parable of the affirmative action employer. Now, before we proceed much farther, I mentioned earlier that it's illuminating to explore the ways that Christian scriptures are inspired often by the Hebrew scriptures. And it's likely that Jesus' familiarity and the general familiarity of Jews at his time with the passage from 1 Samuel is what inspired this parable. 1,000 years before Jesus, King David ruled the United Kingdom of Israel. And 1 Samuel 30:10 tells the story, we could call it the parable of equal compensation for soldiers, in which David went on in pursuit of the Amalekite army. So King David leading the Israelite army against the Amalekites, he and 400 men, but 200 stayed behind. They were tired. They just said, "We can't make it through the valley to pursue the Amalekites, so we'll stay here behind with the stuff." And 200 soldiers went on. 10 verses later, when those 200 men with David returned victorious, we read in verse 21 that when David drew near to those 200 people who had stayed behind, he saluted them. But in contrast to David's generous greeting, the foot soldiers who had been in battle declared, "They didn't go with us. We will not give them any of the spoils that we have recovered from the Amalekites." But David rebukes them in a way that presages the lesson of Jesus' parable. "For the share of one who goes down in the battle shall be the same as the one who stays with the baggage. They shall share alike." Verse 25 goes on to say that from that day forward, David made it a statute and an ordinance in Israel about how wages for soldiers would work, and it continues to this present day. A millennia later, when Jesus is one among quite a few people being declared a potential Messiah, part of what that meant is that we're hoping that that Jesus will turn out to be a king like David. So remember, David ruled over what is remembered as a golden age, when Israel was united and ruled itself, versus a few hundred years after David, Assyria came to power and destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel, and there was only the southern kingdom of Judah left. That's why we didn't have Israelites anymore. We just had Jews, citizens of Judah. So, and it continues to be at that time. And not only did the Jews not rule themselves, Rome, right? Judea was ruled by Rome at that time. So it was hoped that a Messiah would come, restore all the land, and we'd have another king like David. But of course, it's a lot more complicated than that with both David and Jesus, not for the least of which reasons that Jesus didn't seem to want to be a king, and David tried to cover up his affair with Bathsheba by having her husband killed. So it wasn't exactly a golden age for multiple reasons. Rarely are so-called golden ages actually as golden as they are nostalgically remembered to be. We could say the same thing about the 1950s, but depends on who you were in the 1950s, right? So, but we'll set that aside for a sermon for another day. To return focus to our parable, when those day laborers hired at 5 o'clock p.m. received a full day's wages for just working 1 hour from 5 to 6 p.m., those who were hired at dawn at 6 a.m. who had worked a hard 12-hour day leapt to the conclusion that they must be in for the equivalent surprise of much more than the usual daily wage. Shouldn't they receive 4 times more than those hired last, since they had worked 4 times as many hours? Wouldn't that be fair? But hearing their grumbling, you may recall, the landowner says, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. I choose to give to the last the same that I gave to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or are you envious because I'm generous?" And when you read this parable from the perspective of a call to love the hell out of this world, it's important to consider that both then and now, day laborers, the ones that were picked first at dawn, they were the youngest workers. For those workers in their prime, the landowner paid the usual daily wage. It's simple basic economics, supply and demand. To enlist those workers in greatest demand, you have to pay the standard rate. So when all the landowners show up at dawn and all the day laborers are there, to get the best pick, you have to offer the usual standard rate. But when the landowner went out again about 9 o'clock, he saw others standing, still wanting to work, but not able to find it in the marketplace. The landowner had hired everyone he really needed at dawn, as had the other landowners, but there were still people left over. So seeing these people still standing around 3 hours later, hoping to be hired, he took a few more of them and said, "All right, you come with me and you go and I'll pay you what is right." Notice that he doesn't agree with these less desirable workers to pay the usual daily wage, as he had with his first round draft picks, if you will. Nor do the laborers haggle with him over the rate. They're eager to be paid whatever seems right, because whatever seems right is a lot better than going back home to your family being paid nothing. When the landowner went out again about noon at about 3 o'clock, he did the same. And then most shockingly, of course, right, he goes out one more time at 5 o'clock and takes yet more people, even though they did only 1 hour's worth of work. So we could call this the parable of all people who want to work should be given a job and paid a fair wage. After all, contrary to what sometimes seems to be popular opinion, the Christian scriptures are about what would Jesus do, not what would Ayn Rand do, right? From a perspective of full employment, Jesus' parable invites us not only to praise the generous landowner, but also to reflect on the plight and the perspective of the day laborers. Yes, the landowner could be called, in our political speak, a job creator, right? He did generously create jobs that would otherwise not have existed that day for a whole host of workers. But it's important to point out that the usual daily wage for those hired at dawn for manual labor would have been a denarius, a Roman silver coin. It had about the same value of the Greek drachma. Rabbinical sources tell us that that rate is actually not exactly generous. It's not miserly either. That point undercuts the usual interpretation of this story as primarily a vehicle to praise generous landowners. Scholars tell us that the usual daily wage was really enough to only support a subsistence existence. It would buy them enough food for their family just for that one day. That's a low minimum wage. That's not a robust living wage that helps people thrive. Turning the tables, perhaps what those full-day hard workers were excited about was not being greedy, but upon seeing the latecomers, even the latecomers get that usual daily subsistence wage, maybe they were thinking, maybe we'll actually get a living wage for once that could give them a little breathing room financially as a family. That gives us ears to hear the landowner's words as well-intentioned and lined with some generosity, but perhaps also unintentionally paternalistic, condescending, and oblivious to the serious day-to-day struggles of those landowners. So on one hand, yes, he's generous for paying so many people an extra subsistence minimum wage. On the other hand, he hasn't paid any of them a living wage that helps them get ahead. And by hiring day laborers in the first place, he hasn't given anyone a contract. None of them have any sort of guarantee that he's going to hire them the next day or that they're going to be taken care of long term in exchange for their labor. None of them have any sort of benefits. Remember as well that Jesus himself was an itinerant Jewish peasant. It's likely that Jesus told this parable precisely to day laborers who were still there at 9, at noon, at 3, at 5. Because the ones working, they didn't have time to stand around and listen to an itinerant Jewish storyteller. The ones that had time to listen were the ones who hadn't been chosen first. Perhaps also in the audience were some of those landowners who, once they showed up in dawn and had people doing their labor, they could wander back around the marketplace and do things like listen to itinerant Jewish rabbinical storytellers. And stripped of later otherworldly interpretations that were laid onto them, we can see that Jesus' parables originally were radical stories told by this traveling Jewish rabbi who was seeking to reinterpret the Hebrew prophetic tradition to condemn inequality and call for justice in his own day. In the words of Amy Jo Levine, this parable does not actually promote egalitarianism. Instead, it encourages householders to support laborers. But here's the subversive part. Don't just support the laborers, support all of them. More than just aiding those at the doorstep, this parable seems to be saying that those who have should actually go and seek out those who are in need. If the householder can afford it, the lesson seems to be that he or she should continue to put others on the payroll, paying them a living wage, even if they cannot put in a full day's work, and so allow them to feed their families while keeping their dignity intact. The point is practical, it's edgy. Jesus is not actually a Marxist, but he's not a capitalist either. Rather, he's an idealist and a pragmatist, seeking a way to give everyone at least a bare minimum, and his focus is on the responsibility of the rich with those who have. I'm grateful to those of you who have stepped up recently to make possible our two-week shift at the Family Emergency Shelter to give a simple, decent, safe place to live for families in our community who have found themselves temporarily homeless. But may we also work for a world, not necessarily in which everyone is exactly equal, whatever that would mean in light of all our diversity of gifts and ability, but for a world in which everyone who wants to work is paid a living wage, and in which everyone has a simple, decent, safe place to live. But in addition to such large goals, for now and in the coming days and weeks, I invite you to consider, what do you have in abundance? You may or may not have some giant vineyard or some pasture with sheep that you need to go hire day laborers for, but what do you have in abundance? And out of that abundance, to whom might you be called to seek out and practice abundant generosity, never knowing how that may come and pay you back?